The Spotlight.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Spotlight Program. And now, every year, far-right Israeli settlers backed by regime forces hold a so-called flag march in Al-Quds Old City and storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound to commemorate the initial occupation of East Al-Quds back in 1967. And every year, Israeli regime troops force local Palestinians to shutter their stores, restrict them to their homes as hundreds of checkpoints are set up to deny them movement to make way for settlers to march and chant racist slogans against Palestinians, including death to Arabs. Joining us now is Eve Angler for the program, author and political activist, joining us from Montreal. And Saad Nimr, professor of political science, joining us from Birzeit University out of Ramallah. Hello, gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there in Ramallah with you, Professor. My initial question to you, now, your initial thoughts, please, if you could, on the so-called flag march and why it is permitted to take place when all it really does is only promote violence and the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in the area.
The reality of the Israelis, they are trying to assure themselves that Jerusalem is unified from their point of view. Because, you know, in 1968, after less than 1 year of occupation of East Jerusalem, they annexed it officially to Israel. And since then, they were trying in as much as they could to prove that this city is a unified and an Israeli city, but they couldn't because of the Palestinians, because of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, because everyone is going there. And the presence of the Palestinians is so obvious, and especially in the old city inside the walls. So all that, they are trying to prove to themselves that, you know, Jerusalem is unified and it's, you know, part of Israel. And that's why they want to make this march. Otherwise, why they are celebrating with, you know, this kind of march. Additionally, you know that this morning there were 3,000 soldiers and police officers in Jerusalem were deployed. 3,000. If it is unified and it is an Israeli city, do you need 3,000 soldiers and police officers to be in the city if it is unified? And so they are trying, you know, this as much as they could, but they are not even themselves convinced that they, you know, took the place. In spite of the offer which was given to them for Jerusalem by Trump, when he said, I recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, still the Israeli inside, not only Jerusalem, but the whole Palestine, they think that they have doubts always that they might be kicked out and it's not their country at all.
Thank you, Professor Nimr. And Eve Zengler, welcome to the program there, bud. Now, Eve, every year, nothing ever comes good out of this march. So why is it so imperative for settlers to take to the streets and yell, death to Arabs, go back to your villages, dirty Arabs, especially with an Israeli far-right minister at their side?
Well, I think it's just the most crass, violent element of Zionism. And for them, this is about rallying the extremists and pushing the political structure in Israel to, you know, steal more Palestinian land, bomb more people in Gaza, as I saw images of people calling for a second Nakba, you know, expel more Palestinians. And so they want to rally their forces. From a Canadian perspective, I noticed there were flags for Lahava, a racist Israeli group that was, you know, part of the march. That's an organization that in Canada you can give a donation to and receive a subsidy from the Canadian government. So from a Canadian perspective or international perspective, to see the different ways in which the Canadian, U.S. and other governments enable this type of Jewish supremacist, fascist kind of march is pretty disturbing.
And Professor, we saw this phenomena in the same almost exact phenomena, maybe to a much smaller scale, in the States. We saw them extremists walking in the street, ultra nationalists, yelling "Jew, go home." If you remember, it was under Donald Trump's reign, and the public, the media, they were outraged. They wanted to see political leaders, their political figures, show a very fierce response and condemnation. They didn't get that from Donald Trump, and they were irate. We're seeing the same exact thing now in the old city. Why is there such a different narrative when it comes to Washington's reaction?
Not only that the people though are chanting these kind of dirty words. We are talking in Israel, we are talking about ministers who is talking about the same thing, and no one is doing anything to them. If you look at the election programs for Smotrich or for Ben-Gvir in the public eye and around the world, when they ran for the elections with a racist agenda, quite clear, if that happened anywhere else, there would be a huge, reaction. Not only that, Lieberman, when he ran for the elections a few years ago with the agenda of a transfer of the Palestinians out of Palestine, the transfer, and he became a foreign minister, and he was received in all capitals. Can you imagine if any other country had foreign minister saying such a racist thing? Definitely they are not going to be received, and there will be lots of a commotion about his statements. But Israel, always they go away with whatever they want, because by the end of the day they are back, they are supported by the Americans and supported by the Europeans. And I don't, put an exception for anyone. I think all the West are in support of Israel, and shamefully they are in support of Israel, against even their own standard and all what they are talking about of human rights and international law and all this crap that usually they give to us always in the third world countries, all that you are not respecting the international law, you are not respecting the human rights. But when it comes to Israel, there is a kind of a cooperation with Israel. So I think that from my point of view, at least, not only the Americans and also most of the Europeans are participating in this aggression against the Palestinian people and in this racist regime which they are supporting against the Palestinian people.
Thank you. And Eves, if you don't mind, I want to put that same question to you. The hypocrisy, the double standards that we see in a reaction when it comes to racist slurs, to the fact that we see basically two parallel protests, one in the States, one in Al-Quds, and completely different reactions by Western leaders.
Yeah, and I would say that the one in Al-Quds is more dangerous, because you have ministers who are showing up and are directly participating and stoking it. The double standard is stark. The double standard flows from the fact that Zionism is an outgrowth of European settler colonial imperial movement ideology, and Canada, in my case, in the country where I am, has been backing that, from supporting the Balfour Declaration in 1917 to very important role at the UN in 1947, diplomatically enabling the Zionist cause, to the Canadian World War II veterans that fought to ethnically cleanse Palestine, and the weapons that were sent from Canada, to accepting Israel stealing even more Palestinian land than the partition plan, the unjust partition plan, gave 75 years ago to the Zionist movement. And that continues right up to today. And there are many facets to that. There's also a very powerful pro-Israel lobby in this country that is very effective in using the horrors of the Nazi Holocaust to justify, to clamp down on any criticism of Israeli apartheid. And the double standard is stark, but I think it flows from the fact that, the liberal capitalist order in North America doesn't want a, sort of fascist movements in Canada or the U.S. but they're basically fine with that being the case in Israel and so long as it's targeted at dispossessing Palestinians. That's also what you see with, you know, the protest movements within Israel. You see that there's a lot of pushback to the fascistic changes to Israeli Supreme Court and legal structure when it targets Jews, but very little pushback when it's, you know, targeting Palestinians. And the double standard is stark. Anybody who takes a look at it, it's obvious. But the political structure in North America is not based upon any sort of consistency. It's based upon power politics.
Thank you, Eves. And Professor Nimmer, the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, today condemned this law that's before the Knesset right now that will carry a one-year jail term if you hoist the Palestinian flag. There are obviously some extreme elements in the Knesset that really wanted to get this bill through. What does this bill tell us, if it's other than anything, other than a reflection of a gross promotion of apartheid and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians?
Yeah, that in spite of the fact that in Oslo agreement, there was an agreement that the Palestinians will fly their flag, and it's recognized officially by Israel that this is the Palestinian flag. Now the Israelis are going to back on all the other things that they even signed to. And now they consider the Palestinian flag and raising the Palestinian flag would be considered a kind of a, you know, you will be arrested for it or you will be paying, you know, a hefty fine for raising the Palestinian flag. This is something that we express ourselves with. The problem is that the Israelis, they are going more and more towards the right. And I have said that many, many times. I thank God for this government, because now it's exposing the real face of this colonial racist regime in front of the whole world, and to see to what extent this whole world will continue, you know, to turn the face around of what's going on. Now they are following the Palestinian flag, and, you know, and that came in the same day when they got it into the Knesset in the first reading, at least today. It's in the same day with the flag march in Jerusalem for the Jewish community. So it is quite, you know, obvious that they are against. They want to exactly to ethnically cleanse anything Palestinian, not only the people, but also, you know, the ethnic cleansing is going against even the plantations, the homes, the roads, the land, everything. They want to, you know, ethnically cleanse and to erase totally whatever is, you know, can say that it's Palestinian. And one of the things is the flag. The flag is a symbol for the Palestinian people, for the unity, and for their information. The Palestinian flag was there even before the establishment of the State of Israel. We got that flag as a Palestinian flag after 1916. So since 1916, it is the Palestinian flag. And now they are talking about, you know, criminalizing the raise of the Palestinian flag. So it is, they are continuing with their ethnic cleansing program against the Palestinian since, you know, they got here into this country in 1918 and onward. Till today, we are still in the same battle, and we will continue to resist. Not only Hamas, but I think all the Palestinians will be against not only this law, but this is at least one of the laws out of hundreds of other laws against the Palestinian existence in their land. And we, you know, our answer always will be to exist is to resist.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Eves, would you like to weigh in on that? Because that's also tied to the minister. You mentioned that that was marching with these settlers. Itamar Ben-Gvir, he said there is no such thing as a Palestinian identity, a Palestinian language. I don't know how you can say that when they're standing next to you speaking speaking Arabic, and they've been there for God knows how long. But my question to you, when you have Itamar Ben-Gvir, he's part of the establishment, the settlers are calling him our prime minister, basically saying that he's the one pulling the strings in this cabinet and not Benjamin Netanyahu, that he is the true reflection of their sentiments toward Palestinians, and you've seen the kind of very loaded stuff that's coming out of this guy's mouth.
Well, this just comes across as, you know, here you have this very wealthy nuclear-armed state, you know, one of the strongest militaries in the world, and they're scared of the Palestinian flag. I mean, that says a lot. It says, I mean, it's kind of pathetic at one level, but it's also that they are much more vulnerable. They feel themselves much more vulnerable than sort of it may appear on the surface. So I mean, it's just it's hard to kind of not just sort of kind of laugh at at that type of pitiful kind of effort to just disappear Palestinians. Now, yeah, I mean, I think that you have the open Jewish supremacists, aggressively violent figures who are running the Israeli government. That's, I mean, this is taking the mask off of what has been going on for 75 plus years, and I think it's partly reflective of the fact that the Israeli society, the Zionist movement, is kind of drunk on its own power, and it doesn't realize that this is actually probably not smart tactics. That this is turning off many of their sponsors in Canada and the U.S., many of the different political forces that have backed for many decades the dispossession of Palestinians are being turned off by this crass kind of Jewish supremacist politics. Now, in the short and probably medium term, obviously this is very, Palestinians are going to be feel even more of the brunt of Israeli colonialism. But I think that this is not actually smart politics, even from a Jewish supremacist Zionist perspective.
And Professor, how worried should we be, not just as Palestinians, but as anyone else on the planet, that according to Mr. Engler, a Jewish supremacist entity is running, is behaving like this, thinking like this, and then in possession of nuclear weapons on this planet?
No, they are unique in such case. I don't think that the international community would allow any kind of regime in this way if it wasn't for Israel. So yeah, these white supremacists, if you like, more than anything else, colonialists, and they are part of this huge project, even for the United States and for the European. The interest of the United States and the interest of Europeans with Israel is quite important, and they are going, you know, to let go of all these, small mistakes, such as, you know, being racist and being, you know, fascist. It's just, these are small mistakes they can tolerate as far as their interest is there, protected by the Israelis somehow. So, I don't think that could be anywhere else around the world, but only in Israel. And the problem is that it became like normal to allow Israel to have these kind of things. No one is getting even surprised with what's going on, because this is Israel, so like it has the right to do so. Exactly as Golda Meir, a prime minister in Israel at some stage during the 60s, she said after the Holocaust, no one should ask the Jews what they are doing. Regardless, if they are really fascist, if they kill the Palestinians, if they ethnically cleanse the Palestinians, it doesn't matter. No one should argue or ask the Israelis anything because of the Holocaust. So till now, not only the whole world is still paying for the Holocaust, but it's on the expense of the Palestinians. If that was a European problem, why should I, as a Palestinian, should pay the price for it? Whether it is the anti-Semitism before the Holocaust, and the whole Zionist project started even before the Holocaust, and they started cleansing the Palestinian before the Holocaust. We can remember also the ethnically cleansing of 85,000 Palestinians and destroying 22 villages in Palestine. That was in the years 21 till 25. And I'm talking about very early in the history, you know, even before the Holocaust and even before the war and before the Nakba. 22 villages were erased during that period because they claimed that they bought the land and they don't want Palestinians on this land. So this kind of racist movement, it's from the very beginning. It's an ethnically cleansing one, and it's a fascist regime, and it's totally colonial supremacist and colonial white, you know, aggression against the indigenous people. In spite of that, the people are used to it, and they don't blame the Israelis. If that happened anywhere else, it will be a different story.
Thank you, Professor. And Yves, so why do you think the Al-Aqsa Mosque is a destination in this itinerary of the so-called flag march? Because, you know, the settlers know this is going to do nothing but provoke the Palestinians, and basically it's also an expression of superiority over the Palestinian population of the old city.
Well, I think it's designed to provoke. It's designed to stoke religious enmity. I saw one of the chants that was something to the effect of a Jew is a soul, a Muslim is a or something to that effect that some of these marchers were chanting, clearly designed to stoke enmity. This is type of stuff that in Canada, many, many of Israel's supporters would find completely outside of bounds. This would be viewed as so utterly, sort of fringe. And the fact that you have ministers of the government that going there and doing that. So I think that it's designed to provoke. And so long as this Regavim, this charity is, again, a group that Canadians can provide donations to and receive a subsidy. This is one of the groups that's right at the heart of Smoldrich and Ben-Avir's movement. And you can provide donations to them while they support this open racism, open religious enmity stoking, and I think until that ends, right, until they're the sponsors of Zionism, which is principally, of course, Britain, the U.S., Canada, the three main sponsors historically and ongoing. Until that that ends, these forces within Israel are going to feel, emboldened to do that. Now, the upside, the positive on this is that there is clearly growth in understanding of Israeli apartheid within Canada and the U.S. There's clearly, the Palestine Solidarity Movement is far stronger today than it was, decades ago. People don't concede as much to the bogus anti-Semitism claims that, because you support Palestinian rights, you're anti-Jewish and stuff like that. So there is a growth, but still in officialdom in Canada, it's a culture of really basically backing these Jewish supremacist flag marchers that are trying to provoke religious conflict.
And Professor, I'd like you to weigh in on that too. Why do you think that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is part of what the settlers target on the so-called Flag Day? And why Israeli authorities still deny Palestinians up to 1,400 shop owners from accessing their businesses? And a lot of them, there's so many checkpoints, they can't even get home on this very day, but they will not restrict access for the settlers to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, knowing how volatile things can get there.
Well, if we are talking about Jerusalem, the heart of Jerusalem is Al-Aqsa Mosque. And if they manage to, get into Al-Aqsa Mosque and try to divide it, both time-wise and place-wise, as they plan, then they would manage, to say that really we are controlling Jerusalem. So Al-Aqsa Mosque is in the heart of the struggle, especially in Jerusalem, and it is the heart of Jerusalem itself. What they are trying to do is not only to march into Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we have that every morning, because already they had divided Al-Aqsa Mosque time-wise, and every morning from 7 o'clock in the morning till almost almost 12 before the lunch prayer. The settlers are there, and the Palestinians usually will be kicked out of Al-Aqsa Mosque. Today, in this march, because usually these marches are supported somehow by the Knesset and by the government. But this time, it is not supported. It is in the participation of the government and the participation of member of the Knesset in this march, like, you know, some of the ministers were in the march itself, and lots of the members of the Knesset were also in the march. And we believe this is even more, dangerous now for us than before, because we think that, thank God, at least it went on today without anything to go further, because we were afraid, really, that in entering Al-Aqsa Mosque today, that they will stay there and won't leave at all. And I think that would be, a huge battle after that, definitely. But their eyes on Bab al-Rahmeh, and they want Bab al-Rahmeh as part near to al-Maghribi gate, where they come from. Usually, and they want to control it, to claim part of Al-Aqsa Mosque. And if they claim part of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, it's like Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron, it will be a partition of Al-Aqsa Mosque, and that will be really devastating for the Palestinians, for the Muslims all over, because we all know that Al-Aqsa Mosque, with all its premises, 144,000 square meters, are purely a Muslim site, and we should not allow, and we will not allow, no one to claim it, or claim any part of it for the Palestinians. And that's what they were trying to do this morning.
Okay, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you both for joining us on the program. We're out of time. Yves Engler there joining us from Montreal. Professor Saad Nemer there joining us from Ramallah. That brings us to the conclusion of this segment of Spotlight. Thank you for tuning in, and bye-bye for now. ربنا
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on RIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers, sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Bridge. We are looking at supplication number 8, verse number 9 of As-Sahif al-Sajjadiyya for Al-Imam Ali ibn Hussein Zainul Abidin. And we go to the part where the Imam says, O Allah, I seek refuge in you from su'ul wilayati liman tahti aydina. We were saying that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives a person wilaya, authority over certain types of people in his life. And thus, he needs to treat them with compassion, he needs to treat them with love, mercy, and so on and so forth. So we're going through the list of the people that we must be careful of. Now, among the people that we sometimes have authority of, or at least guardianship of, is our friends. Now, when our friends are in our courtship, and when they are in our courtyard, when they are in our presence, in our houses, as our guests, we take care of them. To the point that even in Eid, the day of Eid al-Fitr in the month of Ramadan, that when a friend sleeps over my house, then I have to pay for his zakah, I have to pay his taxes compulsory. So he becomes under my guardianship. Now, obviously, the guardianship of a father or mother or of child is different than the guardianship of the friend. But nevertheless, it's haqqul wilaya. Now, I can mistreat my friend as well, because I just decide to be a bad host or a bad friend. So the Imam says, "Oh Allah, I seek refuge in you from seeking su'ul or being in the state of mistreating or su'ul wilayah for those who are under my guardianship." Let us take a short break and then we come back.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana,
welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge. So, su'ul wilayah liman tahta aydina, becoming bad in terms of guarding the ones under our care. So we're saying the friend, the Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, he himself in Salat al-Huquq, he says, when it comes to your friend, first of all, you have to tukrimhu kama akramak. You have to be gentle, kind, nice, generous to him in the same way he is to you. وَتَحْفِظُهُ كَمَا يَحْفِظُكَ. And you have to be protective of him in the same way he protects you. And you give him the advice that he requires in the same way that you require advice. You don't fall short in treating him, and he should, in the same way, he does not fall short when it comes to you. And all these moral values, all these ethics need to be kept when we are dealing with our friends. So our friends are, in fact, our brothers in faith. Because when we talk about friendship, obviously we don't mean Facebook friends or Instagram friends or followers. We mean literal friends, the friends that the Ahlul Bayt spoke about, the friends who are the people that will always be with us in the dunya and in the akhirah. The friends that will take your hand on Day of Judgment and walk you to heaven because they will do shafa'ah for you. These are the friends we're talking about. Because we have the friends that Allah talks about, the ones that are in line with us in terms of faith, in terms of beliefs, in terms of everything. And there are those who just there for entertainment and fun. We call them friends, but in reality, they're not friends. The friendship that we know and the friendship that's prescribed in Islam are completely different. So keep that in mind. So when we say friend, we mean the Islamic brotherhood, a brotherhood that is thicker and stronger than blood. Okay, so keep that in mind. So when it comes to them and they are under my care and under my protection, under my guardianship, I need to make sure that I don't misuse this trust and this wilaya, this guardianship that Allah has given me over those friends when they are in my presence and when they are under my care. So this is also something that need to be maintained, need to be kept. And let us take a short break and then we will come back.
Listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge. So we are looking at people that we are meant to take care of and can't treat badly if they are under our guardianship. Among those people that sometimes become under our guardianship is the people who are our partners. For sometimes when I come in partnership with a person and I have the biggest share or what have you, then sometimes I am a guardian of his wealth. I'm a guardian of his products. I'm a guardian of whatever that I am a guardian within. I need to make sure that they are safe and kept safe and dealt with safely and so on and so forth. So we can't misuse that, because doing so will be su'ul wilaya, will be bad guardianship. So even the Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, he says, فَإِنْ غَابَكَ فَيْتَ. This sharik of yours, this partner of yours, if he's not away, if he's away, then you will do the job for him. وَإِنْ حَضَرَ سَوَيْتَ. And when he is present, then you are equal with him. And he says, وَلَا تَعْزِمْ عَلَىٰ حُكْمٍ دُؤَنُّ حِكْمَةٍ. Don't make a judgment without having him to make a judgment as well. And do not cheat him. Do not steal from him. Do not backbite him. Do not, you know, do anything that considered to be a moral vice with him, because you have a guardianship over him. The idea is that we have to look at ourselves and see, where am I in this relationship? I am the caregiver, the guardian, or am I receiving? Am I in the giving end or the receiving end? If I am in the giving end, if I am the guardian, the caretaker, then I have to be very sure that this is a great responsibility, sometimes to the state of a burden, that as human beings, we need to do our job as Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants it. And so sometimes, because it's such a burden, such a responsibility, we need help from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to perform at our best. Therefore, Imam Sajjad says, O Allah, I seek refuge in you from su'ul wilayah. I want to do the good wilayah, the better wilayah, the good guardianship, the better guardianship, not the bad one. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Al-Musawi in the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را، هرگز مخواه از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. Dear listeners of IRB English Radio, I am Asma. I have the honor to be your host for today's episode. And here with me, I have Brother Muzaffar and Brother Hassanay. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much, Jazakallah.
And thank you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for having us in the studio.
Yeah, that's a pleasure to have you both in here. Well, before we start, just like the ritual of this program, I would like you to introduce yourself very much briefly.
I'm Muzaffar Haider. I'm from the UK and I'm studying in the Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Yeah, that's very great. And you, Brother Hassanain?
I'm Hassanain and I'm from India and I'm studying in the Islamic Seminary of Qom.
So I wish both of you too much of luck and prosperity.
Jazakumullah.
Well, for today's episode, we're going to talk about something very interesting. I guess the topic of food is very much interesting because there are too many traditions related to food, and in different parts of the world, they have special traditions for their food and for their cooking and whatever. The thing they eat and the things they don't eat. And right now, we're just going to talk about how food and the lifestyle of people, considering the things they eat, is going to be connected with their well-being.
As well as their behavior.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, first, if you talk about the well-being, you know, the human body requires food and nutrients, you know, to work and function properly.
Yeah.
So if we set, you know, external sources aside for some time, like, you know, that affects our health, like the environment, the weather, the climate, and the viruses and all, you know, if we set these norms aside for some time, the main source for the body's well-being is food, what you intake. So that decides your health and health as well. So it decides your health. Like what food you take, you intake, that decides your health, basically.
Exactly.
You have to be a very, very knowledgeable nutritionist to actually give proper advice to people, and the food that you consume varies from place to place. You know, as they say, when in Rome, do as the Romans do.
Exactly, yeah.
So even if you have a certain diet in a certain location, if you move to a different location and try to keep that very same diet, it might not be as nutritious for you in that new place. That's something I learned the hard way.
Yeah, that's very true.
In England, I used to have a completely different diet, and then when I came here, I tried to implement that same diet over here and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, you have to kind of adapt to the environment that you're living in.
Exactly. But, and, you know, the kind of food the people of a certain place eat, it has been managed in a way that is suitable for those kind of people.
Exactly.
With that, you know, with that culture, with that geographical aspects, you know, considering all of them together, they have come to a certain sort of dish that they food, and it's going to be good for those people.
Well, you think for example, for example, if Iranians cannot eat Indian cuisine, right?
Yeah.
It's very hot and spicy.
Yeah, very hot and spicy.
And vice versa, like Iranian food for Indians, it's like just
tasteless.
Bland meat. Yeah, tasteless. Yeah. It doesn't have any taste or flavor.
Maybe, yes.
China as well. China, Japan, noodles. My favorite food actually is pasta. I love pasta so much. And I recently found out that it was actually brought to the West because we often associate pasta with
Italy,
right?
Yeah.
But it was actually an ancient Chinese food. Ancient is a stretch as well. But it was brought by Muslim caravans to the West. Through their trade. And the reason that they did that is because you can transport pasta and it won't go bad.
Yes, exactly. You know?
So that's really fascinating for me as well.
What's your idea about food changing your behavior and attitude?
It definitely does. I mean, if you're a vegetarian,
you're
going to be a little bit softer, you know?
I don't think so.
Oh, what do you think?
Because I live in India, so I've seen many vegetarians. You know, I don't seem to see any, like, you know, major differences between a just a vegetarian and a non-vegetarian.
No, that's because of the chili they use.
Like, I mean, I'm talking about the behavior.
Yeah, I didn't say it will make them less nasty. People can be nasty whatever food they eat, right? But having less meat in your diet will make you less aggressive. Men especially, and women actually, they need a little bit of aggression in them.
Yeah.
They need a little bit of a hunter-killer edge. If you go way back...
Their temper raises very soon.
Yeah, I mean, if you go way back to like the caveman era, what were we? We were hunter-gatherers. That's our fitra. That's what we were created to be, you know? See, the best, most successful people in life are those who have anger within them and they know when to release that anger.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, the positive type of anger.
The positive anger. When there's certain injustice taking place, whether it's, you know, in the political sphere or even in the workplace, you know, when you're being mistreated, you need to have that edge to be able to say, no, I'm not taking this. You know, that's your survival instinct, mm-hmm. and you're supposed to have that. Those who are not in touch with that, you might think that they'll be much more passive and soft. No, they're actually becoming implosive. How? They've actually become, because they're so oppressed and they put up with the oppression and they never stand up against it, they actually become more aggressive when they go home.
So
they become, because they're weaker. You know, see, the actual anger which Islam is opposed to, you know, the bad type of anger, is the anger which you use in the wrong places.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sign of weakness. When are you more likely to get angry? When you're sick. When are you more likely to get angry? When you're irritated, when you're agitated. When do you get irritated, agitated?
When someone is smaller from you.
When you're feeling faint, when you're feeling, you know, not as strong as you need to be to do the job at hand. If you look at any military in the world, putting aside maybe the Indian military and other vegetarian militaries, the standard staple food that is given to soldiers is beef, mm-hmm. is meat.
Yeah.
Because it is proven to give men the ability to fight where they need to.
Maybe this trickness, the seriousness.
This
maybe.
Aggression.
Yeah.
This, let's say positive aggression.
Yeah.
Here, you know, it doesn't need
a kind
to be
of aggression
negative.
That we need to have.
Yeah.
But before we get to know more about this very interesting topic, let's go for a break and then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
So, welcome back. This is Back to Reality, and we're talking about food and how it's going to have effects on my behavior.
Let me just quickly throw these in there, right? Islam recommends that you should have meat at least once every 40 days. And mm-hmm. there's also a hadith which says that if you haven't had meat for a long time, if you know somebody who hasn't had meat for a long time, go and recite the adhan and iqama in both of their ears to bring them back to the path. Okay,
yeah.
You're actually going very, very far away from Islam. You need to have that edge in you.
So we cannot be vegetarian.
Now, I've spoken a lot about meat. I just want to quickly throw this in there as well.
Yeah.
There's also a hadith to the contrary, which say that don't make your stomach a graveyard for animals. Mm-hmm. Right? Don't
you have to
so
be moderate.
Much.
Yeah.
You have to
moderation.
Be moderate. Yeah. There's also a hadith about lentils. There's this lentil that we have. I'm originally from India as well, and it's a very, very common. But that is also recommended Islamically. We have a hadith that say that that's the most popular food for prophets throughout time.
Nice.
You know, so there is this
red lentils.
Red lentils.
People say that, you know, soya and all these are the replacements, but you need.
You can replace it with beans, with totally all
See,
sorts
soya,
of beans.
See, soya. That's a really good example. Because vegetarians are so insistent that you don't need meat in your diet, soya actually increases the female hormones in the male and turns them into something that they're not. It makes them more emotional.
Yeah.
One interesting point over here, like as we were mentioning, that, you know, the nature of meat is, you know, it's warm. Like the some foods, the nature of, like, you know, the fish.
So
it's
even
cold.
Foods have got special natures.
Yeah, like it's cold in nature. Like you know, in winters you have warm foods.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're warm in nature. So you know, these foods like meat is basically, you know, sometimes some types of meat, they're warm in nature. So it gives you the good aggression. And whereas, you know, just eating vegetables and as brother mentioned as well, it makes you softer.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the bad part of it is, you know, it makes you a weak human being. So you become such type of human being that you absorb whatever is given to you, like whatever is happening around you. Even if you're being oppressed, you don't have your own stand. You're not able to fight back.
Mm.
So you need that little positive type of aggression to have your own stand and to fight back the oppression that you're facing. I don't know why they're aggressive.
The militant vegans. Yeah,
they don't eat meat. Okay, that's all right. That's fine. Like, whatever you do, whatever you want to do. But why are you stopping me?
Yeah.
Maybe they have too much peppers in it. Having a little bit of aggression is okay, but where to manifest it, where to show it, that's the question. And
see, you're supposed to be like a lion. When you're like a lion, it doesn't matter how many mice are jumping on you, biting you, scratching you. You just don't get annoyed. You're a lion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When people insist on these vegan and vegetarian diets, they're turning people into bunny rabbits. And then when the mice jump on you, obviously you're going to get angry because it's threatening you.
So it's time for another break. This is the last part of today's episode of Back to Reality. We're talking about food and how is it going to affect my behavior and my attitudes. And we talked about it already. And then let's talk about the forbidden foods.
Like, we're talking about the food traditions, right? Mm. So I want to mention something which shows how the food tradition can affect, you know, one place, one whole area, or one mm-hmm. one city.
Yeah.
For example, like back in the days of COVID-19, there was a news, you know, there were certain Muslim populated areas in India that weren't affected by COVID-19. And you know what was the reason?
Why?
Their food, their diet. The diet was, you know, Muslims, we have a very rough diet. Our food is very spicy in India. Like, we have haleem and biryani. If people know what that food is, the doctors, they gave a statement that these areas, these certain areas, there are less COVID-19 patients. Why? Because the food they have, that gives them more immunity to fight the viruses.
Hmm.
So that was the reason, you know, people used to have spicy food and good meat. So that was the reason they weren't affected by the virus.
Yeah.
So this is how, you know, it affects your health.
A protein does affect the immune system, so there could be some reality.
And that much
it.
Of the spice they're using food. In the food, of course, it's going to have an effect.
The virus would just be like, this is too spicy.
Yes, exactly.
I can't handle it. Another good example of that would be the Mongols. They had the largest continuous land empire in the world.
Yeah.
Obviously, it didn't last very long. But how were they able to do that? They took over the Romans. They took over half the world, you know. And one of the reasons was they weren't lactose intolerant. They could drink milk.
Yeah.
So the same horses that they were riding on, mm-hmm. while they were riding into the battlefields, they could actually stop and have a drink of mm-hmm. milk. Pork, for example, is forbidden. Some people speculate that it actually changes the behavior of people.
Exactly.
You know, we look at the physiological ideas and they say that, you know, for example, it creates worms and stuff in the intestinal tract, etc.
Yeah.
But let's look at the behavior as well. Some say, according to the Ahadith, and some scholars will also say that it actually creates a type of shamelessness in a human mm-hmm. being. If you notice, Islam doesn't recommend any predatorial mammals.
Exactly.
We don't eat lions. We don't eat dogs. Pigs would actually fall into that same category because mm-hmm. they are predatorial, predominantly vegetarian, but they can also eat meat as well. You know, they're scavengers.
But we don't eat predators.
We don't eat predators.
Yeah.
Eating that kind of meat, the effects that it would have on the body, I mean, there's studies that need to be need to take place before we can actually answer it, but I'm assuming that you would become a little bit
a predator.
More like
exactly.
That,
that's
like
what
that
it was going
that's
to
not what
see.
We want to be, right?
Yeah.
Because you are what you eat from your head to your feet.
Exactly. exactly.
It would be like, okay, I want to be a lion, so I'm going to eat a lion. But
yes.
It doesn't work like that. If you want to be a lion, you have to eat what the lion eats. And the lion eats antelope, right? Not, if you want to eat that lion itself, you're going to turn into some weird creature.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. You are what you eat. So we should take a special care about what we eat and what we just take in, because that's going to have a lot of effects on our personality and the way we behave and on many things, actually. So this was all the time that we had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رايزك
يا الله
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رايزك لتصي دايلتك once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Japanese city of Hiroshima is set to host a G7 summit this week, where leaders of the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Canada, Italy, and Japan will address pressing global issues. The meeting is also a source of controversy in other countries around the world, including South Korea, where activists at a Seoul forum slammed the event as diplomatic whitewashing.
This summit is a tool to conceal the terrible truth that countless Asian and Pacific people had to bleed due to 50 years of Japanese imperialism beginning in the late 19th century. It's a blindfold to cover Japan's hypocritical steps towards a nuclear-free world, peace, and rearmament, while dumping nuclear-contaminated water and scrapping its peace constitution.
South Korea's relations with Japan have always been controversial, but especially now as President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to improve ties against the wishes of many South Koreans, who demand an apology for what they call Japan's colonial abuses.
As world leaders flock to Hiroshima, South Koreans are reminded of a history the U.S. and Japan might rather forget. When the U.S. dropped the atomic bombs on Japan, in addition to more than 200,000 Japanese, estimates suggest some 40,000 Koreans were killed. Many of them were forced laborers.
Some South Koreans say President Yoon is moving the country too close to the United States and a military alliance with Japan, which is seen as increasing regional tension. Japanese leader Fumio Kishida invited Yoon to the G7.
The South Korean government's participation is mainly to strengthen military cooperation between South Korea, the U.S., and Japan, and further strengthen military cooperation with NATO, which is mainly led by the United States. If South Korea's participation in the G7 was to reinforce the military alliance as a benefit, that can never be a good thing for the peace of the Korean Peninsula, as well as world peace.
While the summit plans to address the Russia-Ukraine war and economic issues, activists also argue the rich G7 nations need to do more to solve the humanitarian crisis now unfolding in East Africa. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A new report by the Institute of Watson Brown on their Costs of War project, which evaluates the results of the post-9/11 wars on affected countries, says the post-9/11 wars have caused more than 4.5 million people to lose their life in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Pakistan. This study says that some of these people were killed in the war, but a larger number died indirectly due to the destructive effects of the war, which reaches 3.7 million people.
These mentioned casualties have different reasons. One is that the treatment centers have been destroyed due to war, and medical aid seekers could not access treatment. Also, the widespread of diseases due to lack of health centers is countable. We can even refer to using bombs and weapons used in war that had environmental consequences that affected people. Overall destruction of infrastructures and long-term effects of the war is the main reason for casualties.
According to the report, tens of millions of people living in the war zones have also been displaced. The U.S. post-9/11 wars have forcibly displaced at least 38 million people in and from Afghanistan and the other mentioned countries.
Taking responsibility has three steps. First is to acknowledge they are the cause of this destruction and misery, which they don't. Second is ethical acceptance of the results of what they have done. And finally, there should be a higher power to compel them to take responsibility for what they have done. Some might say the UN.